Cycles. Who's the most fun to drink with of the Republican lawmakers? Todd Alba did decide to text us who's fun to get a drink with in the GOP.
Fantastic.
Todd also confirmed that Robin Voss has virtually no sense of humor.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. Welcome to March 1st, Wednesday edition of As Goes Wisconsin. This is the noon hour. Thank you for joining us on your lunch hour. Greg Bach.
Hi.
Was that the first time you've heard that opener from...
No, of course not. I listen to the show every single day.
Did you know that Robin Voss, not that funny?
I knew that without having to hear that. I knew that for a fact. I've been in his presence. I've heard
Have
stories.
You?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that. You've met him.
I worked in Racine. He was...
You got any stories?
I can't tell you, actually.
Really?
Yeah, there's one I can't tell you.
Because you, like, signed an NDA?
No, it's because it was a private meeting between my old boss and him, and things were said, and I was told, and even though, let's just say this.
He used fake names.
Bobbin was hanging out with Ron Fickert. No, I mean, I'll say this. The things that he said in that meeting only go to... solidify his reputation as a cruel, heartless, calculating individual.
Wow. You saw it up close.
Yeah. I think he is the antithesis to what people of Wisconsin believe in. I think he's the antithesis to America. I think he is our Mitch McConnell. I think he is a poison.
See, and I think you guys are so wrong. I think there is a chucklemeister, there is a funny guy buried deep, deep inside his soul that is just struggling to break free.
And you know when that...
And I am here to help him do that.
And you know when that chucklemeister comes out? When somebody falls over. It's that chuckling is always going to come out with the pain of other people.
The only time he laughs is at someone else's expense.
Exactly, yeah. It's never like a good old-fashioned fart joke. Or, you know, Monty Python, which is beautiful. No, he's going to be like, oh, look at that old person carrying all those groceries. They fell down the stairs.
That's so cynical.
Who wants popcorn? Blah, 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 blah.
So cynical. I'm just shocked.
Shocked.
Sorry, Mom.
I didn't know you had actually met him.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the topic for this
no,
segment.
It's not.
But we're going to keep rolling through. So get your thinking cap on for the bottom of the hour, because we would love to hear your thoughts on the different working trends that are happening in this, I guess, post-pandemic. I don't even know what explains it. But there's, on the one hand, there is almost a 6-to-1 ratio of people who are choosing to work part-time.
Mm-hmm.
So less than 35 hours a week. And they're looking for those, or working those jobs, versus people who are looking for a full-time job.
Yeah.
So there's droves of people who are now choosing to work part-time. And there is also a new trend of people working two full-time jobs remotely without telling their bosses.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to do a dive into why this is. And especially with I'm really interested in the two full-time job one, as far as, one, is it ethical to not tell the other, like, to be basically lying and saying, yes, I work for you, and not telling the other one, I also work for you. But also, like, does it matter as long as you're getting your work done?
Mm-hmm.
So that is coming up at 12:30. But to start, stick with me on this one.
Yep.
So we talked about this February 20th, when news broke that a Wisconsin company had been fined for employing over 100 children ages 13 to 17 across, I think it was 6 states. And so it was Packers Sanitation. There's another S because it's the, Yeah, it's PSSI. I forgot what the, it's Packer Sanitation something. And they paid. I mean, as of yesterday, Rick Barrett in Milwaukee Journal Sentinel followed up on the story and said that they did pay the $1.5 million fine. But what stood out to me when we first talked about this was that they were not, this isn't a, like a sole case. And that from one of the articles I read, that since in, is that since 2018, the Department of Labor has seen a 50% increase in child labor violations nationally. So then on February 25th, so this was only 5 days after we first talked about this story, they published a very in-depth, I mean, I think this is, it's a really long article, but it's really well written and researched and investigated. And it's called Alone and Exploited, Migrant Children Work Brutal Jobs Across the U.S. And it basically is looking into, you know, what we do know is there's a lot of people coming across the border, and there is, you know, not to get down the border security thing, but this is a problem. And so it's documented, New York Times has documented migrant children who've been coming to the U.S. without their parents in record numbers and are working on some of the most punishing jobs in the country. So this shadow workforce is part of a new economy of exploitation that extends across industries in every state, flouting child labor laws that have been in place for nearly a century. So the New York Times spoke to over 100 migrant workers, child workers, who described jobs that were grinding them into exhaustion and who feared they had become trapped in circumstances they never could have imagined. Its examination also drew on court and inspection records and interviews with hundreds of lawyers, social workers, educators, and law enforcement officials. So most of these children are from Central America, and the children are driven by economic desperation that was worsened by the pandemic, and the number of unaccompanied minors entering the U.S. climbed to a high of 130,000 last year, three times what it was 5 years ago, and this summer is expected to bring another wave. And so read the article. I will link it in today's show notes, absolutely. But the part that I really want to acknowledge is that this was published in New York Times, February 25th. Within 2 days, the Biden administration said it's cracking down on the labor exploitation of migrant children. So now the Labor Department is launching its own investigation into the companies, suppliers, and factories that may be benefiting from child exploitation. The Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the care of minors in federal custody, is also revisiting the vetting process of people who are sponsoring kids. And in the meantime, federal officials are calling on Congress to increase the maximum fine for the child labor violations, because right now it's only $15,000 per incident, which, as we've talked about before, for some companies is a cost of doing business.
Yep. You build that in.
And so I just want to acknowledge that I don't really have a larger point about any of this besides it's obviously terrible, and really recommend reading the New York Times piece, but also that this is at its highest calling what journalism does.
Mm-hmm.
Is the painstaking, I mean, when they talk about interviewing hundreds of social workers, hundreds of lawyers, like, what the work that went into writing and investigating this piece, and then to know that we talked about this with George last week,
yeah,
which is to know not this that you wrote it for the accolades, mm-hmm. but that something actually changed,
yeah,
and like how quickly this was published, and immediately the federal government was like, okay, we got to do something about this,
yeah.
Well, and it also, as to go along with your point, Kristen. So the government did not know this was happening until someone reported on it, which just reinforces how critically important it is to have local journalism. And yes, that means you have to pay a subscription.
Yeah. You know what? Honestly, like, there's part of me that thinks to myself that there's somebody in the government who knew about it, but they were so low level, they just weren't being taken seriously. And it's that typical thing of like, if you don't do something now, it's going to get worse. And there's probably someone sitting in an office somewhere in DC going, I told you so.
Well, I mean, some people in the, because that was even in the story from the Wisconsin company, there was already people from the Department of Labor quoted in that article saying, we're seeing an increase of this. And like there, I mean, clearly I don't think this is something that no one knows about.
Yeah.
But it takes this much of a spotlight to know that there is going to be public outrage over it and that it better get prioritized.
And it feels like it should be bipartisan public outrage too.
It's also just horrific to me that some of these, the capitalists behind some of these companies are like, yeah, let's just exploit these kids. This is great for us.
Well, that was the thing is like when you were reading the intro, those child labor laws that have been in place for a century, you know that for a century, all those big business people are like, how do we get around those laws though? We can get around those laws. We just got to be creative. And somehow they did.
Well, yeah. I mean, is it that creative just to take kids who are undocumented and say, I know you're here because you're trying to find work. Here's some work.
To them, it is. I mean, to them, they
can't use white children anymore. So let's use these brown ones who are coming here looking for a better life.
I mean, honestly, that is true because they're going to be demonized by there's not a lot of investment in those children. And no, it's no offense to those children. I don't mean they're not. But like, we as a country care less about those children than we do our own unless something like this happens. Then it's brought to light. Like, some people will say, yeah, this has been happening for a long, 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 long time. Other people will be like, oh, my stars. Are you telling me that, you know, this cereal company is employing young children? Yeah, they have been.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got to take a break, but we'll be back in just a minute. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
They see the truth before they can die.
Teach your parents well. Their children's hell will slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked. The one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh. And know they love you.
Hey, Mr. Reporter. How about talking about yourself? Do you like what you're doing?
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair. He is Greg Bach. And we were talking before about the importance of journalism and how it breaks stories and it reports on things that otherwise may get just swept under the rug. And this was in the case of, I think, on a state level, a couple weeks ago, we had heard the Wisconsin company that got in trouble and had $1.5 million in fines for employing children. But then on February 25th, New York Times did a huge story on how big the scope of migrant child labor laws. I mean, like, and breaking those laws has been and has become in across the country. And I had said, you know, how quickly then the Biden administration is moving into action. But I think the same thing goes for, and this is a quick plug for an event that's happening for the Journal Sentinel soon. But, you know, the Journal Sentinel's won Pulitzers. I think sometimes people forget that. And there's an article written by Raquel Rutledge, who's actually we're going to get her on. She's won. I mean,
yes, she has.
She's an incredible reporter.
I've had the chance to talk to her in the past. She's wonderful and just so dedicated.
So dedicated. We actually filmed a video with her yesterday and talking. We basically summarized this article that she wrote that is a promotion for an event that's happening this month. So the event is called Pulitzer on the Road, how local journalism helps you. So it's March 28th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Overager Center in Madison. And there's going to be, it's basically, she's going to be speaking. Other Pulitzer Prize winners are going to be speaking. People from Pulitzer are going to be there. But it's also, it's supposed to be a conversation of how the public can make journalists better. And like journalists, and we say this all the time on this show, we're only as good as you telling us what's happening.
Absolutely.
In your school boards, in your neighborhoods. And so often these stories come from a tip. And then you start pulling on the thread.
Yes.
And then there you go. And so I highly recommend reading, well, and I'll put this in today's notes as well, but reading what she wrote, because she does highlight journalists are not perfect. They are human. But don't let their imperfection think that you would be better off without them. Because I think sometimes people think they would be better off without the media. That the media is so biased and they get things wrong. But in reality, think about the amount of work that it would take to actually uncover the truth about something versus getting to actually read about it, especially now with the internet of just like going, as soon as you have any question, we can go find it. And I now getting to work with a lot of people who work in that newsroom, you know, they work with scientists to test water that they then have to report on. They have to like, Allison Durr, who reports on Milwaukee City Hall, she's trying to work on something. I mean, she's been working on the budget, but she wants to make a video about it. And so she came over to my desk one day and she wants my help because that is what I'm good at.
Sure.
Video stuff and summarizing things. And the manila folder she dropped in front of me that was all things to do with the city budget.
All of her notes.
I was like, I'm not. I love you. I'm not. Like, I will read. This is why I read your articles, just to get the summarized version. Like, I didn't sign up to do that.
That's the opening of the video. You're like, you want to hear about the budget in 1 minute? Well, bam, here we go.
Here we go.
I mean, it is a fictionalized version of it, but the second season of The Newsroom dealt with that. The idea of a story they wanted to report on, but it took them 9 months. In the show to go from hearing about it to interviewing to vetting to more vetting to more interviews to more vetting. Like, they had to make sure everything was airtight, everything was sealed, everything was perfect. And if you watch the second season of The Newsroom, you know what happens in that plot line. But
what is the plot line again? I have to go back. I've been some of the clips from that show, because I watched it when it was on. What was like 2011, 2012? 2012, 2013?
Yeah, sure.
No, early teens.
In the before times.
Some of those clips from that show are popping up again on like TikTok.
Yeah.
And it's so, they're still so relevant.
Yep.
And it's still, Aaron Sorkin is such a good writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to go back and rewatch the show, but what was the plot line for the second season again?
The plot line is that they misreported. Is that a word? They reported on a story. That wasn't true, basically. And this was a massive indictment from a news organization against the United States of like war crimes, that they had like went to a country and used sarin gas on people, which is against a bunch of different regulations and.
Or like rules of war.
Yeah, and the whole thing was like they did all their due diligence. They did like three breakdowns. They interviewing, and it all came down to the idea that they didn't have the correct information. But there was one person who was leading it, who changed information to get it on the air because he was like, I want to see the world burn, because he was so persuaded that the government had done this, that he didn't care how the information got out there, even though once they put the information out there, it fell apart within 48 hours. Like they spent the better part of a year working on this story for 48 hours later for them to be like, we're sorry, we were wrong. Please don't ever.
And wouldn't it be nice if all of our news organizations, because that show was all based off of real things that happened.
2012, by the way, is when it aired.
Yeah. This did not really happen. This was a fictionalized thing. Okay.
But you know, the best real life example of just how long good investigative journalism takes is the Spotlight case from the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
I mean.
Because what was the final from beginning to end? How many years were they working on that?
Oh, it was several years.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that stuff takes time and dedication and resources.
Yeah.
And going up against bureaucracy and politics and all. I mean, God. No, I'd just rather read a story on the air.
So hats off to everyone who does this kind of work. Support journalists. When we come back, working trends. We have thoughts. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair. He is Greg Bach. And we're finally good. We've had a lot. Well, maybe the budget wasn't that heavy. But this is now a little bit lighter.
Yeah.
So, Jane, you and Carol yesterday were talking about quiet quitting.
Quiet quitting, which is a thing.
It's just a thing. It's a trend. What were your takeaways? As two women who have worked for a long time, are you secretly quiet quitting?
No.
Okay.
If I were quiet, no.
I need you. Good.
Are you loudly quiet quitting?
But it's just about, part of it was, you know, Carol and I are from the same generation with the same kind of work ethic.
Yes.
Where no matter what your employer asks you, for the most part, you say yes. Uh-huh. Because that's just the way we were raised and that's what you did. And now younger generations are being a little bit more adamant about what they will and will not do for their employers. And if you're not going to make some accommodations for me, then I'm going to go someplace else.
Which was not the mentality that you...
No.
But also, do you think it's... And I think this is interesting for you, too, because you both chose a career where it was a boys' club. And
yep.
it's still a boys' club.
Yes,
but like,
it is.
The barriers and obstacles that you both... And the BS that you both dealt with is not like what my generation has had to deal with.
I hope not.
And so there is also, did you put up with stuff just because you were so much made to feel like you were lucky to be there at all?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You are fortunate. You are one of the fortunate few, because I can even remember when I was going to broadcasting school, out of the 24 people in the class, 3 of us were female.
Wow.
Yeah.
I got accepted to broadcasting school.
Did you?
I did.
But you did not go.
They sent me a breakdown sheet. Jane, you could probably attest to this. They sent me a breakdown sheet of what you expect to be paid coming out of broadcasting school. And I was like, nope.
Well, it wasn't quite that dismal when I was graduating. And there was at least still the potential to earn.
Yeah.
Like so many business models, newspapers, magazines, you know, things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Because the advertising streams are so different now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there was that work trend that you guys talked about yesterday, which I'm sure will bleed into this. But I saw both of these articles that feel contradictory, but also worth talking about the motivation. And I think just point to, in general, the unpredictable work trends that are happening as far as... when we don't really know, it feels very hard to read the news and in some ways say, oh, we're like on the brink of a recession. If you look at all the layoffs happening in tech, and although I talk to my friends who work in tech, and they're like, well, everyone's finding a job pretty fast.
Oh.
And you haven't seen those layoffs in other places. So then you see something like, on the one hand, more Americans are working part-time by choice. In December and January, 1.2 million Americans joined the part-time workforce. And so basically, there is over 1 million Americans joined the part-time workforce in the last month and first month of 2023. And most of them chose the temporary grind over a full-time hustle. And the downshift is basically lifestyle. choices as far as people who have to be caretakers. And what I think is interesting is the money is basically the trade-off that people are doing is it is worth making a little bit less money to have more freedom and I will just live off of a part-time wage versus and like have the freedom to take care of my child, take care of a different person or
volunteer for something.
Volunteer or just like it's just not worth that extra chunk of cash.
As someone who did that essentially, yes.
Yeah.
For me, like even I mean, I think the argument can be made that with the Laughing Tap, it is a full-time job. It is a full-time job in what I put into it, but I'm not clocking into an office at 8, leaving at 5 every day. There is flexibility within those hours of that job, and then I have my other job at Lakefront, and I have specific times, but I don't work every day either. Between the two, I make enough a year to pay my bills, buy food, enjoy life, and I still have time to myself. I don't feel an overwhelming sense of like this that crushing feeling that a full-time job can have, especially if you're not enjoying it, which, you know, like my old job, while I enjoyed the work, I wasn't enjoying it overall, and it was starting to take a toll on my mental health. So working two part-time jobs or two jobs that are like, you know, non-traditional in their hours, very, very good for me.
And don't you think too, I think with the pandemic, when people were forced to stay home, and granted that was good and bad for some people, but I think people just appreciated, you know what, I can make adjustments to our lifestyle and still live a good life and still do the things we want to do. And as you said, Greg, pay our bills and keep up with all of that. And I don't have to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week.
Well, and I do think when I left tech and having a job that I went to every day, granted, I'm now back in a job that most days I come to every day. And I started freelancing. So that wasn't even a part-time job where I had to show up to. It was the hustle of making sure I had enough freelance work. But it was making PowerPoints and doing data stuff and kind of just using some of the skills I had gotten from tech and the relationships I had gotten from tech to be able to do different projects for different people. And I remember that feeling of how invaluable flexibility felt, of like being able to go to lunch and not feel guilty about what time I have to be back to the office. Cause I'm still of that. I'm getting better, but in general, I care what people think. Right. And so that like effort to be in the office, even if you have no work to do, and just because that's what you're supposed to do is be there and fill the time, even, you know, even if there's not enough to do versus, oh, I'm going to do this. And once it's done, it's done. I can do it at night. I can do it in the morning. I can do it at my schedule. Like that kind of freedom versus this is when you work feeling. I found to be very, it was worth at the time the downshift because it certainly was a pay cut, but it was nice.
Yeah. It just feels better. Like the amount of anxiety I felt towards all the things I was doing once I left the full-time job and I had the part-time job and a little more freedom and support from family saying, yes, do what you need to do to be happy. That fog lifted after a couple of months and I feel better.
Because what was your old job?
I used to be a barber.
And that was like 40 plus hours a week.
That was Tuesday through Saturday, 40 hours a week. And I would go from the barbershop to the club, work until late. Then the next morning, I had to be back at the barbershop by 8 a.m. And then just like the in that world, it's a hustle economy. It's a hustle gig. You got to get clients. And people will come in, but you also got to go out there and meet people and be like, hey, come get a haircut with me. You know, I'm Greg. I won't make you look terrible. And
you have to keep your, like, aesthetic very fresh?
No, they didn't care what I looked like. I mean, as long as I was cutting hair, as long as I showered and I was cutting hair and no one was like, my God, what did you do? Why did you give this man lethal weapons? So, I mean.
And your beard never got in the way?
No, I'm not putting how close do you think I'm getting to them, Jane?
I don't know. I just have this vision of you, you know, giving somebody a little snip and all of a sudden, whoops.
The thing is,
cut your own beard?
The thing is that if you saw a picture of me just even from, so we closed in March of 2020 and we reopened in October of 2020. So from October to October of the year, that 12 months, I worked there. My hair was super short. I was shaving my head for quite a few of those months, and my beard was very short, too. I didn't look like this at all. But they wouldn't have cared either. Like, they don't care about... It's not like, you must look beautiful to cut the beautiful. It's just, get a good haircut. Have a good conversation. Don't charge too much. But that job was... It was weighing on me heavily, and it was, you know, me being the person I was thinking, like, oh, man, I'm doing a great job of hiding my pain. I was like, you know, you're not doing a good job at all. But once I did it, because I think, Jane, to what you were saying, as far as, like, you know, I know I'm not the same generation as you, but I do have that feeling of you get a job, you go to that job, you work at that job. They tell you what to do, you do it. You can question. You're not going to be a jerk or anything about it, but, you know, this is my job. I have a job. I get paid.
That is the exchange.
That is the exchange. So to come out of that to say, like, no, I can do what I can still, as long as I'm paying my bills, as long as I'm able to buy food, as long as I'm able to live a life, be comfortable, okay, I'm good. This feels better. This feels more like me. And I'm hoping that people of Jane's generation, I think they did it, of my generation, of yours and younger, are seeing that, like, it's okay to take care of yourself. You can still work. There's plenty of jobs out there that you can make your money and still live a life and be comfortable and be happy and live without that anxiety and all those things that come with a full-time just clock in, clock out job. That's not for everybody.
No.
It's still hard to say no, though.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my gosh.
It's still hard to say no.
I generally will say yes 95% of the time when I ask to do something, unless I know I cannot do it because of time commitments. And it's generally time commitments. If I know that I can't be two places at once, I say no. But if I don't have to worry about that, I'm like, I'll help. I can do this. I'll take care of this. What do you need? Because that for me is just feeling like being a good guy. Because people need help.
Team player?
Yeah. Yeah. And all the team. And the thing is, all the teams I'm a part of are good teams. Yeah. That's the other thing, too, is it's hard to say yes to a guy where you're like, well, I heard a great quote. It says, Why bend over backwards for a company that won't think twice about replacing you 15 minutes after you left? Versus like being a part of a team with like, we value you. You are part of this. You contribute. We, you know, you bring a certain perspective that is great and necessary and you feel valued. And then you're like, yeah, I'll say yes to things.
But I feel like there's also people who would say, no, a job is a job. Like you're getting paid.
Yeah.
And that's all the value that you should expect.
And that's fine. And that's fine. If that is the understanding.
Yeah.
Like if you walk into a job and like, this is a job, here's the pay, thus and so, fine. But like I used to work at a job where they didn't have the money to pay us more. So I suggested more benefits, like maybe a half week of extra vacation, maybe this or this. Just show that we're valued. Mm-hmm. You don't have to give it to us in money. You can give it to us in other ways. And I'm not talking about a $10 gift card to Applebee's. I'm talking about like
a pizza party.
Ooh, a pizza party. Who doesn't love a pizza party to make the minions not mad? But yeah,
or just being told we appreciate you.
But he said directly to my face. He goes, "You have a job. That's your benefit."
Yeah,
I was like, I got to get out of here.
And I think that's the thing. It's like, if that is the exchange, then it becomes, if that's the understanding, that's your choice
mm-hmm.
to be able to say, I got to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you're someone who, there's certain people who feels trapped in jobs and whatever. But hey, medical
keeps a lot of people trapped in jobs.
Medical insurance certainly keeps people feeling like, I can't quit this job.
It's funny you say medical because I wasn't, when you said medical, I wasn't even thinking medical. I was thinking, I mean, how many lawyers and doctors do you know who hate being lawyers and doctors, but they spent so much time and they were expected, whether it's family or whatever.
The sunken cost?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the sunken cost, but just, yeah, the sunken cost of doing it all. But that thing of like when you were 18, you're like, I'm going to be a lawyer. And you're not going to tell an 18-year-old they don't know what they're talking about. So they're going to be a lawyer, but they don't really realize the money, the time. And it's nothing like what we see on TV. It's like, yeah, you're going to be in an office working on contracts, working 100 hours a week, making $120,000 a year.
Sometimes more.
But you're also going to be paying off $300,000 in school loans. You're going to be paying on a mortgage. If you have family, this is not the life that you envisioned.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I want to shift gears, still on work topics when we get back, but on the other end of part-time work versus two full-time jobs and the increasing number of people who are doing that, because they can get away with it, apparently. Stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin. As Goes Wisconsin. She is Jane Matinair. He is Greg Bach. I am Kristen Bry. Let's switch it up a little bit.
All right.
So we've been talking about job trends and how we're all existing in a new, brave new world of different working conditions and working arrangements and part-time and quiet quitting. But also, the increasing amount of people who are taking advantage of the of being able to work remotely mm-hmm. and the amount of jobs that say you can work remotely that have taken it upon themselves to have two full-time jobs, which to me feels like the expectation, I think, when you have a full-time job is that it is at least 40 hours a week. So for these people, are they really working 80 hours a week? Or is it a week? Or is it a combination of stolen time because you're and there's they talked and this isn't this I found this article in Slate and it's literally called "What's Really So Wrong About Secretly Working Two Full-Time Jobs at Once?" and it was written by Allison Green. And they have some examples that I think are objectively a problem. Mm-hmm. So if you are dropping the ball on your team, if you are in Zoom meetings and you're constantly like taking yourself off camera or like on mute and people can tell you're talking to someone else.
Yeah, that's bad.
And so if you're like, it's becomes very apparent that you're doing both and you're not doing one or both well, then I think that's room for concern. But on the flip side, if you can pull it off, is there anything wrong with it?
I think if you can pull it off and it's the understanding of, if I'm the boss and you're the employee, I say, I just need you at the end of the day when you're, I need the work that you need to be, I need the work that you, that's assigned to you to be done. If you can get it done and you're working from home, I actually don't care if you do it at 1 o'clock in the morning. I don't care if you do it at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, get it done, then yes. But if you are to be on call from a certain time and you are pulling yourself away and making yourself less available and possibly making mistakes, then yeah, then there's a problem.
I just feel like it is vaguely unethical.
Say more.
It seems like something an unethical company would do.
Well, we're not talking about the company. We're talking about the...
I understand. But it just seems vaguely unethical. If you're going to do that, then I think you need to be straightforward and tell these companies the truth. That you are doing this for... I am doing X for you and I'm doing Y for them.
Mm-hmm.
And because otherwise... One day you're going to get busted and it's not going to be good.
And I think that's the thing. It's like, I think there's two different things. There is the expectation of, at a, like a service job where you need to be in person.
Yes.
But in a remote job, if the expectation, especially like think about sales, if you're hitting your quota, and this happens for people who go into the office or not in the office, one of the things about sales is a perk, I think too, that appeals to people is, it's very binary. You either hit your goal or you did not.
Yep, right.
And if you hit your goal, people largely leave you alone. And in other jobs, it's maybe not as binary, but largely if you're hitting your goals, if you're doing your job, does it matter if you're doing it in 10 hours or 40 hours? And then I think you're right as far as the lack of transparency slash lying, depending on which one you want to call, because I don't think the people who are even doing it well are necessarily telling the other company, oh, by the way, I'm also working for these guys.
If you are lying, then yes, there is a problem. You are straight out lying. But if I'm working for a company, like there's one person they interviewed who had two jobs that required 50 hours and they were basically making almost $500,000 a year. Ugh. If you are upfront and you tell them what's going on, they both sign off, then yes, of course, there's nothing wrong with that because you're going to get the job done as they expect it to be done. If you are lying about it or if it's a sin of omission, but they can clearly be like, you're clearly working on something else while you're supposed to be talking to us, then there's the problem. That is unethical. That is unethical.
But I think the person that you're referencing from the article, she didn't tell both jobs.
I thought she said she made it clear. She said they were in no competition. And she got the work done, and none of her work suffered.
But I don't think that means that she necessarily told her employers.
Just that she was getting away with it.
That same person deleted her at LinkedIn altogether. So there was no looking at her LinkedIn.
Oh, I thought that was a different person.
I'm pretty sure that was her. At the bottom of the paragraph, it says, I'm not listed on either company's website. Only C-levels are listed at both, and I deleted my LinkedIn account.
My other question surrounding this is, what are they doing from home that they're making $500,000 a year, and how do I sign up for that?
It's probably
each job is $200,000.
Again, I'm flexible.
Yeah.
I would like to know. It's like, are you in marketing? Are you engineering?
Really? What exactly does that? What do you do?
I mean, but she says here, she goes like, I'm a very conscientious person. Don't accept mediocrity. Tend to do great work. So far, I've been able to handle competing responsibilities regarding time-sensitive conflicts. Both jobs are strategic, and in general, I don't have tactical concrete work products with due dates. So, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, if she's able to do all that stuff, or he, I
think it's a she. I don't know why I thought that, but.
And if they're not asking questions, then if the work's getting done, then that's something I have zero problem with, because if their work isn't being impacted, then do your thing, Jellybean. I mean, it said right here, the means work, she's able to take care of business and do all the things, averaging 50 hours a week. $400,000 a year worth of work at 50 hours a week.
Wait, is that all she's working is 50 in total?
But so far, I'm averaging 50 hours a week. I mean, come on.
I wish.
So I think that... I think that when you're lying about it, when you're trying to pull a fast one and you're not doing a good job of covering your tracks, then there's going to be trouble.
You're going to get
fired. Yeah.
But if you can, you're in camp, if you can get away with it and you're doing a good job, what's the harm?
Yeah.
Jane, where do you fall?
You better come clean. You're going to get busted.
But what's the busted?
That you're not fully
dedicated to the one company that they assumed that you were.
I guess to me, we're looking at two different ways, though. Like, I'm looking from the pie in the sky. I agree with both sides. The pie in the sky woman who's 50 hours a week, $500,000 a year, yeah, she's doing her thing. Good job. The people who suck at it, who are like zooming, like, I got to pull away for a second. They're like, you're clearly talking to somebody else. Then yes.
Get out of here.
Speaking of get out of here.
All right. Well. That wraps up our noon hour. Thank you for listening to our lunch hour, but we still got another hour left today. When we come back, a statewide theater fest, world premiere Wisconsin. We're going to be talking to the festival coordinators when we get back. Stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin. I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah. I don't want to do your dirty work no more.